guys. At this time, we begin the TechNet online lock. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. We'll also hear John, KC2 WGB, who handles the mailbag and also monitors EchoLink. So if you have trouble getting through with EchoLink, quite often John can find out about that. He can also leave in messages. We also have Paul, WS2N, who gives us the space report. And I'm not sure, but I think it's going to be space report number 145 tonight. Let's say, or 146, one or the other. Let us know what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing. Along the way, Hal, K6DPZ, gives us what he calls the brief reports. He has quite a lot of experience with lots of different kinds of ham radio equipment. Let me drop. Over the 32 years that the TechNet has existed, and this is TechNet number 1553 of the series that began in September of 1982. Over those 32 years, we've slowly developed a kind of a menu, and that menu, we don't hold to it real strictly, but we try to, and that is for the first questions or comments for the net. That's followed by John dipping into the mailbag, and you probably remember, a few weeks ago, I mentioned the fact that a person with a handy-talkie in his house, unless the house is favorably located, you might have marginal communication to your favorite repeaters. And if you were willing to put even a very inexpensive coat hanger antenna on the chimney of the house and run a cable down into the house, which passes by the favorite rooms, and you got a T-connector in each one of those rooms in the cable, that you can tap into that T-connector with a lanyard, a jumper lead, an RF jumper lead coax cable coming out of your handy talkie. Let me drop it. Now, by way of that technique, no matter which room you're in, you tap into that T-connector that's in the cable in that room, and you now are talking through the antenna on the roof, and that can make you roughly 20 decibels stronger. That's the equivalent of raising the power of your handy talkie by 100 to 1. Instead of your handy-talkie running 5 watts, if you ran 500 watts, that's the performance you would get. Okay, somebody, one of the really sharp guys that write emails or mailbag questions to John asked a question about that exact situation. If you put a time domain reflectometer on that cable with the T-connector, with cables going off to one side, what would happen? Darn interesting question. We'll be getting into that when we go to the mailbag. Good job. The TechNet in general is intended for people who are curious. Arguably, mankind makes the most amount of progress when somebody experiences curiosity about something. Even if he thinks it's useful or not useful, even if he thinks he can make a dollar on it or he can't. When mankind expresses curiosity, that's when progress is made. And a significant percentage of the people who sign into and listen to the TechNet are the people who do have curiosity. They want to know how this mysterious thing of action at a distance called radio, how does that work? How do those signals go out into space? How in the world is that signal, that the QRP signal of about 6 watts from the Voyager spacecraft, it's out there 12 billion miles, 3 times the distance to Pluto. How in the world does that signal get that far? In miles per watt, it's obviously the record holder. So, as you can tell from what I've said so often, once you transmit a radio signal somewhere into space, even if it's just leaking out of your dummy lobe, but you transmit a radio signal, strong, weak, doesn't matter, that signal you transmit goes to everywhere in the universe. And so, if you're using the right equipment, no matter what location you go to, even inside of a screen room, the screen room doesn't stop the radio signal, it attenuates it. Even if you're behind a hill, behind a mountain, behind a great big building, those things will attenuate the signal still gets there. Some of it diffracts around the edge, some of it refracts through the building, some of it reflects off of other objects. There's zillions of ways that the signal goes. And even though you're standing on top of a mountaintop talking to your buddy on top of another mountaintop, you think there's nothing but the direct line of sight air signal. not necessarily. That signal you're transmitting is bouncing off of every other thing in that environment, every tree, every building, every chunk of ground, even in the case of 10 gig signals, even off of clouds and raindrops. That signal is bouncing off of everything, and there's only a million paths by which it gets from point A to point B in almost every situation. My job? So there are people who are curious about how does an antenna do that? How does a transmitter do that? How does that signal in free space do all of that? That's the magic of radio. We discuss that. There are people who have got that curiosity, want to know more about it, how to improve its performance, how to use all of that stuff in a useful manner for you. That's some of what we discuss. That by giving that group of guys, Hal, John, Paul, and Dick, you give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. And in between each one of your transmissions, try to remember to listen for the four beeps. It's very easy to know that, hey, somebody's about to call you, you get anxious, and you squeeze the button real fast before the four beeps come along. And that can create a timeout of the system. Let me try something else. Okay, I see that we do have the Eastern repeater tonight, although we're getting it by way of a internet connection. It's got a little bit of delay to it, but at least the Eastern connection is working tonight. It did have a dropout this afternoon, that was noted. So, give me your call letters and your name and the word yes, because you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in simply because you're listening. After 32 years and 1,553 tech minutes, we believe somebody is listening. We've made that leap of faith, if you know what I mean. Alrighty. Give me a call that has a name right now. KTRIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Terry, Jay.
WHYY, Joe, yes. Question and comment.
Okay, we've got some mysterious guy, KE2EJ, who didn't give us his name, but I'm going to make a guess. It's Eric. We got Eric and John, and Eric and Joe. Joe with the double entry. Okay, anybody else assigned him with a tech, with a question or a comment, give me a call at his end name right now, KQRIW.
KD2HUC, Steve and yes.
That's one of the guys that we've had a nice discussion with about this long cable going through the house with T connectors that goes up to an antenna on the roof. Okay, Steve, looking forward to it. Anyone else, give me a call at his name if you want to check into the TechNet.
To ask Paul with a space report. Good evening, John. Good evening, Dick, and everybody else.
Very fine, Paul. And one last call. Anyone else with a question or comment to the net? Give me your call letters right now. KQRIW.
N2YYC, Howard, yes.
Well done. Howard gave us a nice sign-in. YYC. Haven't heard from you in a while, Howard. Okay, now Eric, the first guy, number one on the runway is Eric tonight, and I know it's going to take a little while before my favorite antenna of yours is back in operation, and so how are things with you tonight, Eric? And Eric, for those who don't know, is the main broadcast engineer for PBS television for Channel 13 in New York City, Channel 21 out in Plainview, so he's the guy that keeps all of that electronics running, as well as a pile of electronics connected to this repeater system, both the Eastern and the Western machines. So my guess is all of the above is keeping you running these days, Eric. KE2EJ, we're going to have to buy you a new set of track shoes, K2RIW. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, Dick, I'm almost at the place where I got to switch over. I am headed to Sheldon to see why the link radio doesn't seem to be working, so, well, if you hear some weirdness later, you know why. That's all I wanted to say. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Okay, Eric, so we'll, when you create occasional disruptions to the operation, you tell us, hey, I'm going to be knocking you guys off the air for the next 3 minutes while I do this, this, and this, we'll know that it's coming. To be forewarned is to be forearmed, and we've been forearmed. We've been forewarned. Thank you, Eric. Okay, Joe, what's the latest with you these days? W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Well, I have a question to come. comments. I'm not sure if I can both be handled on one TechNet because they can get a little involved. So would you like the question or the comment?
The choice is yours, Joe.
Okay, we'll start with the comment first. Okay, and that is, I just heard you mention about using an antenna system with several leads going around the house to work the repeater, because a lot of times people walk around with an HD and you can't hit the repeater, either one, VHF or either system here. I'll tell you very quick what I've done, and I use it on my own repeater system, and it works very, very well, even though I'm like about maybe 10 miles away from where my repeater is. Being inside is always going to be spots that are noisy, and you're going to end up running full power on the radio. I use what's called an extender system, where I program one frequency on my radio to receive my repeater output, and I transmit elsewhere other than its input, way far away. And then what I have in that set up in the house is a radio installation where I'm transmitting out to my input on one radio, but my receiver of that radio, it's basically looks like a miniature repeater, just like back to back with a couple of commercial radios, receives elsewhere. And that lets me walk around the house, bring extremely low power, like about a quarter of a watt, and hit the repeater full quantity, anyways within maybe even 500, 600 feet away from my house. And I can talk through my repeater through my house radio, which is set up to be about 20 watts or so. So that's an idea that people may want to explore. You're buying old commercial radios and turning them into simple repeaters within the handband gives you that flexibility and makes you totally wireless, where you can walk around to your heart's content, not being tied to one room with a wire. So that's the comment.
Okay. Sounds like you didn't want to give us the question right now. You want to give us the comment. And for you, that works very well, Joe. You're a guy who has set up, over the last 20 or 30 years, lots of repeaters and all kinds of experience in doing repeater operations. The number of guys who feel comfortable with setting up a small, local, private repeater system within their house, where the low-power handy-talkie talks on one link of the system and the other portion of the system talks to the outside repeater. The number of guys who will feel comfortable doing that is not quite as high as you would like it to be. Whereas the direct wired system requires only a couple of dollars worth of hardware. It doesn't require two more radios to do it. And people have gotten the misimpression that coaxial cable is so extremely delicate that if you put a T connector or an adapter in the middle of a coax cable, you're disturbing its operation. Let me drop. There are people who think that that's going to create a whole lot of insertion loss and a whole lot of standing wave ratio and disturb the operation. And now a T connector with a coaxial pigtail lanyard going off to one side of that T connector going to the handy-dorky, they think the whole system's going to crash and burn if they did that. And by way of the question that's being asked by a real smart guy sending a communication to the mailbag to John, you're going to find out it's nowhere near as bad as you think. You'd be amazing how forgiving a handy-talkie and the whole coaxial cable system is in that situation. And even if you think it's going to create disruption of proper operation of the transmission line, there's a very simple operation where the T connector that you decided to tap into, whether or not you leave the rest of the transmission line going downrange to the other rooms of the house, or just open up that other BNC connector, you can make it perfect, if you know what I mean. You're now using a T connector as a right angle adapter, and it'll have an extremely small perturbation at 2 meters or 450. By the time you get up to 10 gigs, that would give you a little bit of grief, but very few of us go up that high. So the simple coaxial cable system to a coat hanger antenna on the roof of the house can make your signal 20 dB louder, as if you had gone 100 times higher in power, and it's only a couple of dollars worth of investment once you understand the theory of operation and are willing to do that instruction, that installation. So I think it's a bit simpler than yours. Yours is a better technique. Let me drop it. Yours is a better technique because it gives you complete portability. Once you set that system up, the thing in your hand, you can now walk into every level and every room of the house, and maybe even into the backyard, maybe even halfway down the block, and still keep talking through the repeater with good signal. So your system has a great deal of advantage and portability, wirelessness to it. But some guys will consider that a little bit too elaborate for them, a little bit too much of an investment to buy and properly install all the extra equipment. For you, it's easy. For some guys, it's going to be a little bit hard. Now, by way of this conversation, people know they get at least two solutions to the problem, and there's probably two or three more. Glad you brought that to our attention, Joe. Why don't you hit us with your question while we got you? W2RYY, K2RYW, the TechNet.
Okay, I'll get to that moment. I just want to just add some things to the comment part of what I brought up here. To make a set of radios repeat, you don't need a duplexer. You just simply need some separation between one radio to another. Now, you have to use commercial equipment. Yes, it's a way for me to make it work for me, and it works fine, and gives me total portability. And the repeater coupler between two particular commercial radios, like old Motorola mobile radios, they can be found on eBay. They're very cheap. They're about $35, $36. So, you know, it depends on what somebody wants to do. And there's many ways to solve problems, as you brought up on the TechNet. So there's one approach, and then there's another approach. So you brought up one approach. I brought up another approach. So my question is, dealing with model aircraft that are using systems where you're on one frequency, say like 2.4 gig for controllability, and you're using another band for downlinking video, is there an easy way to test, or is it more complicated because it's digital to test the amount of descent you would get on that deploying device as far as how much how weak the signal can be coming into that digital receiver before it doesn't, you know, interpolate the signal correctly anymore because you're transmitting elsewhere another band, but you're still on the same, whether the same, craft itself. Is there an easy way, or is that a more complex thing to try to get tested, to try to find out if there's any kind of, interference issues as far as that would determine your range of your craft? Back to you.
Now, when you go to the NEAT Fair, NEAT, Northeast Astronomy or Aero Technology, something along those lines, September of every year, a guy named Tom Wolf from the Seafly Club, Silent Electric Flyers of Long Island, he holds this conference in, can't think of the name of it, it's near Monroe, New York, near Roscoe, New York. is the actual location. There's this old 150-acre or 200-acre campground in a very nice valley in the Catskills where this year was going to be the 10th or the 11th NEAT Fair, in which he brings together approximately 350 pilots, maybe about 100 different vendors, and they hold this conference that lasts for at least 3 days, although the really enthusiastic people come from five states away, and they come a week ahead of time. So these group of electric radio control powered model airplanes, in other words, no internal combustion engines. These are all battery powered aircraft, and some of them are extremely high power, really fast things. I mean, some of these things can fly a couple of hundred miles an hour. Some of them are quarter scale and one third scale of the real full size airplane. We're talking some pretty big hardware here. And thank goodness the AMA, you've got to be a member of that to be a pilot, Academy of Model Aeronautics. Once you join that organization and pay your dues, this is something like $30 a year, you're getting something like $2 million worth of liability insurance. Okay. At least 5 years ago, let me drop. At least 5 years ago, a certain number of those guys were doing what's called first-person operations, first-person piloting. In other words, there's a camera on board the radio-controlled model airplane, sending a signal back down, and sometimes the guys are wearing a headset, or it's actually a helmet, where the visor of the helmet is the video screen. In other words, they feel like they are the pilot on that airplane, and in their hand is the transmitter that controls the airplane. And some of the most exciting things you can do with that airplane is, while it's flying across the sky, aim it at you, and you're looking at that pilot standing on the ground who is controlling the airplane, and it's you. All right, so these guys doing first-person operations. As I said, at least 5 years ago, they were starting to do this with a fair amount of enthusiasm. Nowadays, you've got these quadcopter drones, and a significant number of those have got built-in cameras, and some of them have got really good stabilization systems. If you go to QRZ.com and you dial in the call letters of K3LR, K3 Lima Romeo, and that particular guy in western Pennsylvania has a couple of acres of property with no less than three or four towers of the 100-150-foot altitude with all kinds of antennas. He's got a contest operation that's very difficult to beat, if you know what I mean. Okay, a couple of guys, if you go to that website, QRZ.com, K3 Lima Romeo, and you go down a page or two, you'll see where a couple of people have taken a quadcopter with camera on board and flown it over his towers. And you look down with these very steady photographs that would much more steady than you would get with a commercially flown piloted helicopter. Let me drop it. By looking at those YouTube videos, you will see what some of these modern-day quadcopter with camera on board is capable of doing. And it leaves nothing to be extra desired, if you know what I mean. It's as perfect a flight as you could get with all kinds of stability. And it's the equivalent of having a hummingbird or a real good bird that's able to hover at your command, and you're looking through that bird's eyes to look at the side of the tower, the top of the tower, the side view, the top view, whatever. And so it gives you some idea of what's possible. Now, almost all of these model aircraft, radio-controlled aircraft flying with electric motors these days, 98% of them are using 2.4 gigahertz digital systems. And these digital systems are such that each individual pilot has his own individual digital code, so to speak. The system automatically selects that. As such, during the warbird events, in other words, one of the events they hold at noontime on Friday and noontime on Saturday, or is it Saturday and Sunday, where they'll put 35 aircraft in the air simultaneously doing dog fights with each other, cutting each other's streamers or whatever. Complete bedlam. All 35 of those aircraft are all on their own. They're all on the exact same 2.5 gigahertz frequency region with their own individual codes. So these modern-day digital systems have extremely good post-detection processing techniques by which an awful lot of what you and I would call furtherant modulation distortion and all other kinds of squittery, phony signals, the system is able to ignore all of that. Let me drop it. And so, yes, without a doubt, some of these aircraft, when you got 35 aircraft in the air simultaneously, some of them do have accidents. Some of them strike the ground because the pilot ends up looking at the wrong aircraft. I mean, of those 35 aircraft up there, maybe two or three of them look exactly like yours. And if your eye jumps over to the wrong aircraft and you're controlling the wrong one, all kinds of nasty things can happen. So almost all of these accidents that happen are pilot error accidents. They're not because of the radios themselves fail. And sometimes a guy will even have a camera in one of those. So what I'm getting at is a well-designed system with a camera on board transmitting back, usually on another frequency, but not necessarily. And those systems have been reasonably well tested for electromagnetic interference between those systems. Yes, if you study the military manuals about how you confirm all of the chunks of electronics that are on a modern-day Air Force fighter airplane, how you confirm that every one of those 30 different pieces of electronics, how they don't interfere with each other, it's an extremely elaborate test of turning on various things in various combinations to find out if there's any detriment in performance of any of those systems. It can be an extremely elaborate, difficult test in order to quantify. Then again, with modern-day equipment, with good design, there's ways of drastically minimizing that, and it's not a showstopper. It's something to certainly be concerned about. You're on the right wavelength on that one, Joe. But the darn many guys have done it so successfully with these first-person situations where you literally feel that you are the pilot on that airplane. Let me drop it. And in some cases, they've got enough channels on the radio control system so that as the pilot on the ground,
wearing this headset where he's getting the view as if he was the pilot on the airplane. And they've got, somebody's got to, they've arranged that if he tilts his head, if he tilts his head to the left and to the right, the camera,
as best they can.
on the eastern input. Am I making it through? NY2H?
Yeah, you're coming through beautifully, Joe. Not to worry. And thank you. It turns out that the modern 2.4 I've got the ability to.
Yeah, Joe, when you come in, I'll kill the inputs on this side, so it won't bother you. Dick, you're kind of sharing the same as the previous view, so if you can do something else, that might be good. Turn it back on.
Can't add himself to the conversation. Like an intelligent human being. It is amazing.
Now, to answer your question, Joe, if you buy the right 2.4 gig system, it is full duplex. Not only do you have as many as 9 or more channels of uplink where you're controlling individual ailerons, rudder, motor, wheels, pilot's aiming of the camera and whatever, they also have multiple channels of downlink in which you can get individual cell voltages, altitude, airspeed, engine RPM. So you buy the right system, and that is built in to be full duplex with that digital system. And are they doing it with a timeshare or frequency share? I'm not quite sure how they're doing it, but you buy the right system, and they're not very expensive. So you can monitor a whole lot of parameters on the airplane. If you're flying a sailplane, for instance, it would really like to know what's the rate of rise or fall. Am I in the middle of a thermal? Should I steer a little bit to one side or the other to get the nice green air that's going up? If you know what I mean. So these systems are leaving very little to the imagination, if you know what I mean. They can do an awful lot of things. I don't think they've gone as far as to make the video downlink as part of that duplex system. But as I said, there's at least two brands, at least two model numbers within two of the major brands. And we've got one of those, by the way. We've got one that has the capability of monitoring a number of channels of information on the aircraft and sending it back down. So radio control model airplanes are, and particularly the electrically powered ones, they've come a long way, Joe. And it's a hobby that once you get into it, it's going to compete with your ham radio. And combining the two is amazing. The number of guys who are flying, the number of guys who are flying radio control model airplanes who also have a ham license is amazingly small. And why? I mean, they both are heavily dependent on radio systems. And why those hobbies don't get combined, I'm kind of amazed. In the contest that I flew in with my radio control glider about 15 years ago, I had my call letters on the wing of the airplane, and there were 30 other pilots on that field, and about 25 of them asked me, "What is that?" And so I'm amazed how little cross-coupling there is between those two hobbies. And by the way, Hiram Percy Maxim, one of the founders of the American Radio Relay League, used to fly model airplanes. W2RYY, K2RIW.
I was on the east frequency. It didn't transmit you, so I'm not sure what you said back to me.
Okay, it's too bad you didn't get a chance to listen. Let's see, I'm hearing everything coming out of the eastern repeater right now with delay. So to repeat the highlights of that, the modern-day radio control transmitters you can buy, and they're not very expensive, are full duplex. You've got as many as 9 channels of uplink where you're controlling everything on the aircraft, from ailerons and wings and motor and rudder and elevator and flaps and so on. And some of these systems, at least 2 of the models of 2 of the major brands, have downlink telemetry information where you can be monitoring individual cell voltages of the battery, aircraft altitude, aircraft speed, engine RPM, and so on, temperature. And so they are a full duplex system at 2.4 gigs, at least 2 of the models that I know of, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Dick. I'll have to, you know, look into it some more, do some, you know, interneting around and find out some more about it. It's just a bit interesting. But the main thing, like I said, it brought up the topic of the interference issue, but apparently from what you're saying, that's not really a major thing to be concerned about. Okay, thanks for the information on the subject. Back to you, and that'll end it for me for this one.
Yeah, good comment, good set of questions, Joe. And I wouldn't say the interference capability is insignificant. Something you've got to take advantage of. You've got to be considerate of. However, a number of people have done it so successfully where those video downlinks in many cases are considerably longer in range than the visual range of the pilot looking at his radio control model airplane. So a number of guys have flown the airplane back home by looking at the video link because they couldn't see the airplane itself and know in what direction it was aimed. And they were, you know, following roads and railroads and stuff like that to get back home to the airfield. And so if you have the slightest interest in radio control model aircraft, simply Google the word NEAT, N-E-A-T, or NEAT Fair, which is coming up in September of every year. The 11th annual will be this coming September, and my son and I are going to the last five or six of them. And if you want to see some really serious pilots, 350 pilots flying these extremely high-performance aircraft, just sitting and watching those, whether it be quadcopters, highly maneuverable helicopters, or these ordinary powered aircraft, and jets. Quite a few of them are literally ducted fan engines running on brushless DC engines that are brushless DC motors, turning numbers like 35,000 RPM, and it really is a jet aircraft, if you know what I mean. So these guys have gone, they've come a long way. All right, the next person on the list was Steve, KD2HUC, and he's a man who's got quite a bit of experience with electric-powered vehicles, really high-power electric-powered vehicles that draw numbers like 5,000 amperes. Over to you, Steve. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the tech pack.
Good evening, Dick, everybody in the TechNet. My question tonight is regarding a project that I undertook this past weekend. A little background. My initial VHF, UHF setup was a mobile transceiver in the basement about a little shy of 100 feet of LMR 400 up to a fiberglass vertical on my chimney. And about halfway into the transmission line, I have an Alpha Delta Lightning Arresta. This past weekend, I replaced the first leg from the shack to the Lightning Arresta with a half-inch Andrew Hardline Heliax. When I initially installed the LMR, let me let it drop. When I installed the LMR 400, when the installation was complete, my SWR was about 1.3. After completing the upgrade to the hardline, at VHF frequencies, it went up to about 1.4, 1.5, and up as far as 2, up in the 440 range. And I'm at a loss as to why. Now, just to validate the measurement equipment and the test leads that I was using, I brought the radio over to the Lightning Arrestor, eliminating the hard line, and I hooked it up there, and everything went back to 1.3 on both frequency ranges. So I took everything apart, I double-checked, I rang everything out, and I can't see anything wrong. I don't know why the SWR went up. So I was hoping maybe somebody who has a little more experience with hardline might be able to point me in the direction of what I should be looking for. Back to you, KD2HUC.
I can tell from what you're saying, Steve, that you believe that the change in the system over the hardline was the thing that keyed these changes in standing wave ratio. And as long as the connector on the end of the hardline is properly installed, and that can be confirmed by way of just feeding a signal through the hardline and going at the far end into a known 50-ohm dummy load and measure the standing wave ratio. And if you want to be double down sure, measure it in both directions, because occasionally standing wave ratio equipment reads differently in the two separate directions. It's a complicated reason for that. So confirming that the hard line itself as an element is working correctly, you can test it all by itself. To find out whether or not the lightning arrestor is an aggravating factor, some lightning arrestors do create a significant amount of standing wave ratio. So it can be tested separately with a demi load on the output end and your standing wave ratio measuring equipment on the input end. And the standing wave ratio equipment could be anything like an antenna analyzer, a Viswa measurer, or a directional wattmeter, a Berg wattmeter. Whenever you measure forward and reverse power ratio, whether you're going through a long piece of cable or a very short object like a lightning arrestor, it's an equally valid test. There are people who think you can't measure something that's real short, that only long things will register correctly, and that's not true. Let me drop. So what you're talking about here is the cascading of individual objects. If the 50-ohm coaxial cable, your hard line, had connectors properly installed and there's no kinks in it and no chunks of water inside, if the lightning arrestor all by itself tests well, if the LMR 400 tests well, if the ANA tests well, I mean, there's a divide and conquer approach here that I'm strongly recommending. Measure each of the individual components. Yes, you will on occasion. You could get a 1.2 standing wave ratio of component A, a 1.2 standing wave ratio of component B, and you put those two components together. Because of the reflection coefficient of one adding in phase with the reflection coefficient of the other, if you are unlucky to have just the wrong length of cable, so to speak, a pair of 1.2s can become 1.4. A pair of 2.0s can be 4.0. You can get a multiplication of standing wave ratios when you put two things together. You can get a division. If you took those exact same two objects, where each one of them is 1.2, and you put them together and you get each one is 1.2, and you put them together and you get a 1.4, and if you now change the length of one of them by roughly a quarter wavelength, all of a sudden the 1.2 of each becomes 1.0. You can literally divide Viswas. In the best case, you can multiply Viswas. In the worst case, that's if there's two objects. And if you've got three objects, cable A, lightning arrestor, cable B, and the fourth object being the antenna, you can get all kinds of combinations. So, standing wave ratio, let me drop. What's happening here is as the signal travels down your transmission line, and it hits the first object that's less than ideal, maybe it's the lightning arrestor, and you get a certain amount of reflected power there, but 95% of the power goes through. And now it hits another interface, some other change of cable, connector, antenna, or whatever, and you're getting a reflection from the second object. And those two reflections coming back down the cable can add in phase and out of phase. That's how you can get this multiplication effect. That's how you can get the, that's when they're in phase adding. You can get the division effect when they're out of phase adding, if you know what I mean. So standing wave ratio, a little bit complicated. And by the way, even if you got as high as a 2-to-1, most pieces of UHF equipment, VHF, UHF equipment, will laugh at a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Most of our 2-meter equipment and 450 equipment, with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, you lose half a dB of potential power output. Let me drop. And that is not a showstopper. However, your 80 through 10-meter rig, your no-tune radio, which is running at 100 watts, it's got a very sensitive final stage. It's looking for anything above, let's say, a 1.5 standing wave ratio, and it starts cutting back power to go into the self-protect mode. So your 80 through 10-meter rig could be very standing wave ratio sensitive, and your 2-meter equipment and 450 equipment will just laugh at it. And so most of us would lose sleep at night because of a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio at 450. In the worst-case situation, it's half a dB of loss. You'll never know the difference, and 98% of the time, the equipment will keep right on cranking into a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So depending on what frequency you see it, you might be able to ignore it, but by way of divide and conquer, you will eventually find out where it's coming from. And there's lots of different instrumentation that can help you. And there are times when you'll get some confusing readings, which this division ratio and this multiplication ratio I just mentioned, there are times when that can drive you crazy, where you know each component has got high VISWA, and you put them together, and the result either gets a hell of a lot higher or a hell of a lot lower. And at first that sounds crazy, I know, Steve. KD2HUC, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I guess I probably should have mentioned that too. The length of the cable did change, because I was in the process of relocating the shack, and it got approximately 25 feet shorter in length when I installed the hard line. The other thing that I did see, which I guess makes sense what you're talking about, is when I was taking the power reading, you know, my transceiver puts out 40 watts at UHF, and the meter was, you know, pegging a 60-watt scale. So I can only assume that was an additive effect between the transmitted wave and then the reflected wave coming back, and, you know, somewhat in phase, unless I'm misunderstanding. As far as the lightning arrestor, the rest of the system, like I said, I validated that. I brought the radio right over to the lightning arrestor and the cable going up to the antenna, and everything, you know, the SWR of that entire portion of the system was back at 1.3. So the only portion, you know, that seems to be raising the SWR is the hard line or the connectors that I'm using through the wall. And like I said, I'm pretty certain that the terminations are good. I rang them out. You know, I tested them for shorts and whatnot. They seem to be pretty solid. So I was, like I said, that's why I was asking, because I'm not as familiar with hardline as I am with, you know, other forms of coax. Back to you, Dick, KD2HUC.
WH4RY.
Joe, recognize, get to you in a minute, Joe. The hard line might be a red herring. By that I mean, and whenever you install connectors, of course, to do a short and open test with an ohmmeter is the necessary but not sufficient as a beginning test. And then the real, the gold standard is to put a known 50 ohm dummy load on the far end of the cable, and at the input end of the cable, measure the standing wave ratio, reflected power ratio, VISWA, and so on. Whichever instrumentation you've got. And so to ring out each individual component one at a time is a good thing to do to get to the bottom of what's going on. But when you see 60 watts going forward, coming from a transmitter that you know only can produce 40 watts, that's a very confusing situation to many people. If you literally had 20 watts reflected in the system for whatever reason, because of standing wave ratio, the 20 watts coming back to the transmitter, let me drop. Most of our transmitters are things like transistors or tetrode tubes. In either case, the transmitter is nearly a constant current generator. And although it gives rated performance when it sees a 50 ohm resistive load, you would think, therefore, that the transmitter is a 50 ohm source. In almost all cases, it is not. If you had the right kind of instrumentation, where you could look back into the transmitter while it is transmitting, with difficulty that can be done, you'll find out that the transmitter is nearly an open circuit. It's a constant current generator. It's got a very high impedance. And as such, 20 watts being reflected back to the transmitter, because the transmitter is nearly an open circuit, the transmitter cannot absorb that reflected power. It gets re-reflected forward, and the 20 watts reflected to be reflected forward at 20 watts, added to the transmitter power of 40, and you end up with 60. And there's a lot of guys that will see these relatively high forward powers and say, hey, that can't be real, that's reactive power. In most cases, it's real. You put a directional coupler on there where you're sampling 10% of it, in your case, that would be 6 watts, and you connect that output into a 6-watt light bulb, and you'll get full brilliance. It's real, if you know what I mean. And so the fact that you've read a crazy amount of forward power, once properly interpreted, it can be real, and it give you another clue as to what's going on. W2RYY with some further comments. K2RYW, go ahead, Joe.
Yes, letting the ID go by. Steve, I have a question for you directly. one comment I'm going to make, I think I talked to you directly on this repeater a couple of weeks ago about this problem. The difference between using half-inch heliacs and 7/8 is half-inch heliacs, you lose about 71% of your power at 100 feet. With 7/8, you lose about 83% would get through. So like 100 watts, you'd have 83 watts, the other end, the other one. Damage for giving like 71 watts with the 100 watts in the other end. My question for you is, did you connect to captive pins, or did you use connectors that you had to put the connector on and put the pin solder directly to the center conductor of the half-inch heliac? Back to you. Big chili.
Nick, would you put me at the end of the list? And to Leo. Leo.
Steve, you got it. Rich, we heard you. Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, Joe. Yes, it was me, and I want to thank you for the advice, first off, on not going with the 7/8. You were 100% right. I definitely had my hands full just with the half inch. The connectors that I used, they were not, they do not get soldered. They snap on the back nut snaps onto the shield and then draws the forward nut into the connector. It was not a solder type connection. It was the connector that was recommended for the cable, by Andrew. They were relatively self-explanatory. I did not use the automated cable prep tool. I used the EasyAx prep tool. So it took a little more manual involvement, for deburring and flaring and so on and so forth. Back to you, KD2HUC. KD2HUC.
Joe, I know that you wanted to know, Joe, you wanted to know which one of the two kinds of connectors, captured or non-captured. Tell us a few words as to what are the pitfalls of each one of those and what you were concerned about. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Then you could put on LDF4-50. If you got that pin spacing wrong, it could change the J factor at the connector, but change your impedance a little bit either way. But I think the major thing you're probably dealing with here is where you're getting maybe a little bit higher in VISWA than you want. And it just goes to test with a 50 ohm load of known accuracy at the far end of the cable. Might be the shield connection between the copper jacket of the cable and the connector itself. I don't know if you had to flare the connector, the jacket out to make it 50 connector proper, but that's very critical because I've done plenty of those type of cables of half-inch heliac and 7/8, and flaring the cable, the copper jacket out so it's evenly distributed as far as contact pressure around the connector becomes very critical. I've seen people do it like with a pair of pliers where it looks like a pie crust edge. And that could definitely change the VSWR at that point when you try to test it. Back to you. You try to test it.
Either of these methods of installing the connector, the good way or the not so good way, when you test the cable by itself into a known good dummy load and measure a standing wave ratio from one end to the other, that's the gold standard. And while doing that, do a little bit of mechanical stressing of the connectors on each end. In other words, try twisting them clockwise, counterclockwise, left, right, up, down, and so on. That'll also give you a clue. If the standing wave ratio changes while you're mechanically flexing the connector, which should be a very solid connection, that's another very strong clue. But by divide and conquer, one component at a time, measuring standing wave ratio with reasonably good equipment and a reasonably good dummy load, is going to give you a lot of information as I see it, Steve. And please come back and tell us what you find. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, I guess that's, I'll have to get my hands on the dummy load, and I'll certainly start by looking at the connection. Just as info, Joe, I actually, I spent the extra coin, and I think it was like $50 or $60 just to get the Andrew flaring tool for the cable. I didn't go the homebrew route with needle nose. I actually bought the right tool to do it. And but I'll go back and I'll double check and make sure that everything is flared nice and neat. And and then we'll take it from there. The, you know, like I said, I'm at a loss. But thanks for the advice, and I'll definitely let you guys know how I make out. Back to you, Dick. KD2HUC.
So we'll be looking forward to hearing from you, Steve, on what you find out. Next guy on our list was Howard in 2YYC. Howard's one of those lucky guys that lives in Belmore. And on many weekends, Belmore holds a very good flea market at their at the train station parking lot. And Dave in 2APG has found some real good bargains over there from time to time. And 2YYC, K2RW, you got it, Howard. You got it, Howard.
N2YYC. Yeah, I've been to that flea market. I haven't seen much radio stuff, but I guess anything could show up there. Didn't really have a question. Just was I'm looking for assistance. I want to put up a antenna or a G5RW. Looking for somebody who has some experience who could help me put it up.
Connect off.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link clear.
K2RIW here on the eastern input, which is coming through the machine. Better than the western.
Hang on a minute.
Roger, Dodger.
John, handling all the questions, and before you go to the mailbag, I have a question for you, reference your R7000, because I heard you talking about that last week on one of the other repeaters.
Okay. Should I go back into operation?
Net tonight at 8 o'clock, W2VL repeater system.
Dick, listen to 85 and tell me if there's any delay now. There shouldn't be.
Okay, right now, no. When I go through 375, there is no delay coming out of A5. Eric, go ahead.
All right, thanks. Give me about 2 more minutes, and then you'll be back in normal operation.
Roger, Dodger. Am I allowed to keep talking here while you're doing that, or should I stand by?
You can talk all you want. I'll tell you when I'm done.
Okay. And I like the quality of this linking system you've got. There's a little bit of echo, which I think is on your end. I don't think it's on my end. Okay. G5RV is the antenna that I think you're talking about, Howard. And so you're looking for somebody that'll help you put that up. And now the next question is who we've got in the Belmore area, who's a Limock member or Lockfield member or whatever, or the Nassau County clubs and so on. There are guys who are very good at installing antennas, and if you can get one of them to volunteer, that'll help an awful lot. But the really heavy work, where a lot of installation is required, I've told people to get a hold of Woody Woodhouse, K2UU, Kilo 2 Uniform, when it comes to significant installations that he has done over the last 40 years. He's very well equipped. But putting up something as simple as a dipole-like antenna, a G5RV, I'm not sure we should bring up the big guns for that particular installation. So I think about the best you can do, let me drop it. About the best you can do is that on a number of times during the day, on each of the repeaters you go to, tell people you're looking for a volunteer to put up your G5RV dipole-like antenna. And out of curiosity, Steve, here we go, Howard, what kind of support have you got? In other words, are you capable of putting the center of it on the chimney of the antenna, of the house or on the tower, and on the two ends, is there a convenient tree? So what kind of supports have you got? How difficult is it to get to the roof of your house in order to do that part of the installation? So give us a little bit more of the info there, Howard. N2YYZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.